WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, best-selling Turkish novelist Elif Shafak. When her new novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, was published in Turkey, she was accused of public denigration of Turkishness under the Turkish Penal Code, Article 301. She was acquitted. Under the code, as many as 60 writers, journalists, scholars, and intellectuals have been prosecuted. Last month, one of the journalists convicted was murdered by a Turkish extremist. Now many Turkish intellectuals and writers find their safety threatened. Also, illness from a patient's point of view. We talk with Dr. Michael Stein, author of The Lonely Patient, How We Experience Illness. It's about what he's learned from the patients he's treated. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Elif Shafak, faced 3 years in prison for comments made by characters in her novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, which has just been published in the U.S. Shafak is from Turkey, where Article 301 of the Penal Code makes it illegal to insult Turkishness. And for those Turks behind this law, one of the most egregious ways of insulting Turkishness is to use the word genocide when describing the mass killings and deportations of Armenians by Ottoman Turks beginning in 1915. Shafak has acknowledged that her novel tackles a political taboo, quote, what we in Turkey call the Armenian question, unquote. One of the characters in Shafak's novel uses the word genocide. The Bastard of Istanbul tells the story of two families, a Turkish Muslim family in Istanbul and an Armenian American family in San Francisco. Shafak says the novel is about the tension between the need to examine the past and the desire to erase it. Shafak was acquitted of violating Article 301, but a journalist who described himself as an Armenian from Turkey was found guilty. That journalist, Hrant Dink, was assassinated last month. Now many Turkish writers and intellectuals, including Elif Shafak and the Nobel laureate Orhan Pamuk, find their safety threatened. It's unsafe for some of them to publicly discuss what happened to the Armenians in 1915. I spoke with Shafak yesterday. Elif Shafak, welcome to Fresh Air. What was the significance in Turkey of the murder of Hrant Dink?
I think the best way to understand that is to look at Hrant's funeral. It brought people of all sorts of ideological backgrounds, people of all walks of life, ethnicities, religions were there. And it was a very poignant, moving experience. Everyone was chanting, "We're all Hrant, we're all Armenian," and Christians and Muslims buried him together.
What was he tried for before he was assassinated?
He was tried several times for insulting Turkishness. He was an outspoken critic of lots of things. But basically he was someone who wanted to bridge the gap between Armenians and Turks. I think he wanted to be a bridge. And he believed that these two communities had much more in common that they wanted to recognize because of politics. And he very much believes in the need to empathize with the others.
What does this mean for other Turkish intellectuals and writers and journalists who are independent thinkers?
Well, I think in Turkey, ever since the late Ottoman era, intellectuals, intelligentsia has played a very fundamental role in terms of triggering social transformation. This is the case right now. It was the case in the past. But of course, after Hrant's assassination, everybody is very nervous. And several writers and intellectuals have been given police protection. Right now, everything is quite tense. The investigation is still going on. It's still too early to talk about. But the government is taking the investigation very seriously, and hopefully everyone who's culpable will be brought to trial because of this.
Would you describe Article 301, which is the law that Hrant Dink was tried under and you were tried under?
It's quite ironic, actually, because Article 301 was part of the reforms process. I mean, it was introduced as a positive step, as a progressive step. In terms of bringing the country to EU standards. And when compared with the older articles that were a stumbling block in front of freedom of expression, it was in itself a step forward. Nevertheless, the problem with Article 301 is that it's quite vaguely formulated. What does it mean to insult Turkishness?
Right, it prohibits public denigration of Turkishness. What does
right,
that mean?
Right, but what exactly that means, I mean, nobody's quite sure of. And that's where the problem lies, because it's so vaguely formulated, it is open to interpretations and therefore misinterpretations. So that's the problem with the article. But in addition to that, some civil groups within civil society, groups with more ultranationalistic tendencies have exploited this article in order to silence critical minds, in order to bring critical-minded people to court. So the article is open to exploitation, and that was the biggest problem with it.
You were the first person charged with violating Article 301 because of a work of fiction.
Right.
What were the parts of your novel that came into question, you know, that were accused of insulting Turkishness?
I mean, my case was a bit surreal. Until today, Article 301 has been used to bring various people, various journalists, editors, publishers, even translators to court for denigrating Turkishness. So in that regard, my case was yet another one. But in another sense, it was quite unusual because, as you said, this time it was a work of fiction, and more precisely, the words of fictional characters that were seen as a problem. Basically, some of the Armenian characters in my novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, say negative things about Turks or the history of Turks and Armenians. So those words were singled out and used as evidence that I was denigrating Turkishness. And that was quite surreal.
And let's talk about some of the things those characters said.
There are some Turkish characters in the book who have a negative opinion of Armenians. And there are some Armenian characters in the book that have a negative opinion on Turks. The book, the novel, is composed of multiple characters. You know, there are many different characters. One of them, for instance, Auntie Varsenik, at some point talks about the 1915 events, massacres and deportation of Armenians. So that paragraph has been cut out and used as evidence. Let me give you another example. At the beginning of the book, there's a very vivid character called Aunt Zeliha, and she's walking on the streets of Istanbul. She's very angry, you know, furious, and she's swearing at the rain, at God, at everything, including the Ottoman dynasty for once upon conquering Istanbul and then sticking to the mistake. So that paragraph has a certain, you know, level of humor in it, but the whole paragraph has been singled out, and I was accused of denigrating, belittling our ancestry. So it wasn't only the Armenian characters in the book, but each time a character said something negative about our past, that was singled out and cut and used as evidence.
Now, the prosecutor in your trial said he saw no grounds for indictment, but a judge reversed that, and you were indicted and tried anyways. And how did you finally get off?
Well, we went through several stages. At first, there was an interrogation, and that was dropped, and we were happy. I mean, I thought I was off the hook, to tell the truth. Because the prosecutor concluded, you know, there was no ground for that. But what happened was this ultranationalist group of lawyers, they took the case to an upper court, and somehow the upper court reversed the decision of the lower court, and the trial was automatically initiated. And that was quite unexpected, frankly. It was a legal twist that I wasn't expecting.
And were the charges finally dropped?
They were. I was acquitted at the first hearing.
Now, you didn't go to the trial because you were about to or had just delivered your baby.
I had just delivered my baby, yeah. I was at the hospital still.
That must have made it even more surreal.
It was, and I remember at some point, you know, I was in the hospital room and I was watching TV. The case was all over Turkish media on the Turkish channels. So I was watching a group of protesters burning my picture on the street. And on the one hand, you see such violence, such hatred. And on the other hand, you're in this hospital and babies are born every minute. You know, there's optimism, there's hope, there's faith. The dark side of life with the bright side of life, you know, it's always side by side. That was quite surreal. I mean, the whole experience was very, very surreal.
Now, the group behind these trials is called the Unity of Jurists. It's right. an ultra-nationalist group.
Right.
What do they stand for?
What makes me sad is they're a very small, you know, limited number of people, but sometimes, especially people in the West, think that they compose, they represent the whole Turkish society or the majority of the Turkish society. I don't think that's the case at all. Let me tell you my experience. This novel came out on the 8th of March, the International Women's Day, because it's a book in which women play a very, you know, fundamental role. And ever since the day it came out, it became a bestseller in Turkey. It was read, circulated, and discussed freely. It sold more than 120,000 copies to this day. And I had a tremendous positive feedback from very different segments of Turkish society. So my general experience with the readership in Turkey has been quite positive. But then after 3 or 4 months, like a backlash coming, this group sued me, and because of that I was interrogated and brought to trial. But what I'm trying to say is Turkish society is composed of different voices, and this group is only one among many voices. They do not represent the majority of the society. And frankly, my opinion is they are targeting intellectuals and writers precisely because they want to stop the EU process. They have made it very clear that they're against Turkey's EU membership, and they would like to see the country as a more insular place, a more xenophobic, you know, nation state, a closed society. That's what they would like to see happening. So I think we're not the real targets there. The real target is Turkey's EU membership.
One of the real controversies, and something that's gotten several people into trouble, including yourself in Turkey, is the question of whether in 1915 Armenians were killed by Turks in what has often been described as a genocide. And what's, you know, there are many Turks now who deny that that happened. And so the whole question of history is at stake here. And the meaning of history for Turks and Armenians is one of the subjects of your book. Can you talk a little bit about how you see Turks and Armenians having a different sense of history during that period? Or a different sense of the importance of remembering history?
Right. When I set to write this novel, I not want to deal with macro questions. You know, that wasn't my starting point. My starting point was, you know, a very simple fundamental duality between memory and amnesia. And I think that's an important duality for individuals as well as for collectivities, for societies. It intrigues me to see how Armenians, especially the Armenians in the diaspora, how they tend to be past-oriented, memory-oriented. Whereas when you look at the Turks in Turkey, that's not the case at all. We are more future-oriented. And in some ways, we are a society of collective amnesia. So it's not only 1915 that we are unable to talk about, but the whole past. For many people in Turkey, history starts in 1923, the day the Republic was established. That is the beginning. And anything that might have happened before then is of no real interest. I mean, people have lost their connection, their sense of continuity with the past.
Why did you want to go there, you know, to go to what is perhaps the most controversial question in Turkey and deal with it in your novel and deal with characters who are facing it?
As I said, my starting point was this duality between memory and amnesia. And basically, I was dealing with one simple fundamental question. If the past is gloomy, is it better to know more about it? Or is it, you know, preferable to know less about it and to let bygones be bygone and be more future-oriented? I think that's a very central question, not only for, you know, societies, but also for individuals. And maybe my own childhood was my inspiration, because my childhood was a bit gloomy too, and that was a question I asked myself. You know, is it better to probe it, to know more about it, or shall I see the past as a completely different country and be more future-oriented?
My guest is Turkish novelist Elif Shafak. Her novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, has just been published in the U.S. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Turkish novelist Elif Shafak. Her new novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, was a bestseller in Turkey, but it was also accused of insulting Turkishness, which is a crime under Article 301 of the Penal Code. She was tried and acquitted. Your new novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, among other things, deals with out-of-wedlock sex and abortion. Now, in writing about female sexuality in a secular but predominantly Muslim country, what were some of the issues that you faced? I mean, for instance, in an essay, you asked the question, how can a Turkish woman novelist approach eroticism and sexuality in her writing? How did you answer that for yourself?
I think the Turkish case is quite unusual, and it's very interesting because we have a tradition of state feminism, and this sounds like an oxymoron, but this is precisely what happened in my country. With the establishment of the new Turkish nation state, creating a new Turkish woman became one of the biggest ideals, one of the biggest goals of the reformist, of Kemalist ideology. And they introduced lots of legal reforms to accomplish that. On the one hand, it was great because more and more women were able to enter into the public space and to be visible in professions like lawyers, doctors, you know, you name it. But on the other hand, women's visibility in the public space was possible when they defeminized themselves. And I think that's very important. And in addition to that, the state was above everything. So, I mean, it was a feminism introduced by the state and controlled by the state. To this day, when women are talking about those reforms, they say, for instance, Atatürk gave us our rights, or the early reformists gave us our rights. Now, when you say the state gave me my rights, that's something else than saying, you know, we women earned our rights by an independent women's movement. It's a big difference, because in the former, you are grateful to the state, and when you're grateful, you can't question it anymore. I think what we need is an independent women's movement in Turkey.
So do you think that women ended up having to publicly desexualize themselves in
right.
order to have the freedoms?
Right, and in time, this created a tradition. Even today in the intelligentsia, I can see this pattern repeating itself over and over again. The best way to ensure that a woman is respected by her brains rather than, you know, by her work is for her to age as quickly as possible. I don't think it's a coincidence that in non-Western societies or in societies like Turkey, women age very quickly. Especially, you know, women who want to prove themselves with their work. Because when you're old in the eyes of the society, that's okay. Then you have no connection with femininity, with sexuality anymore, and people respect you more. So to become old in the eyes of the society is safe ground. But when you're young and when you're a woman, that's not a good combination in the eyes of the society. What I have observed is women intellectuals, women writers have developed different strategies to deal with this patriarchal pattern. they either try to age themselves very quickly or they try to defeminize themselves. I think these are different strategies to cope with the same problem.
What was your strategy?
Well, I try not to do either, you know. I try to follow a different path, which I see as the Sufi path. Because, you see, although sexuality is repressed, at the same time, we also have, in the Middle East, in the Islamic tradition, a very rich literature in which sexuality and pleasure and delight is venerated, is praised. And there's a huge literature, you know, a big history behind that. So my path, my strategy has been to dig into that literature and to bring back those roots in which delight and body and sexuality and especially love has been praised and emphasized. I like that literature. I like that tradition very much, and I think it's time to remember it.
Elif Shafak is the author of The Bastard of Istanbul, which has just been published in the U.S. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from ThinkMap, maker of the Visual Thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the loneliness, anxiety, and pain of illness. We talk with Dr. Michael Stein about how his patients describe and experience illness. It's the subject of his new book, The Lonely Patient. And we continue our interview with Turkish novelist Elif Shafak. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Elif Shafak. Her latest novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, was a bestseller in Turkey, but it also led to charges that she denigrated Turkishness, which is a crime under Article 301 of the Penal Code. She was tried and acquitted. The charges came from tackling a subject which she describes as a political taboo in Turkey, the mass killings and deportations of Armenians by Ottoman Turks beginning in 1915, which is described by many journalists and historians as genocide. Shafak's novel also deals with sexuality, abortion, and pregnancy out of wedlock. You've written that you had two grandmothers, one who believed in the religion of fear, the other the religion of love. What were the differences between how they approached life and how they approached love?
Right. you know, my point is sometimes Islam is seen as a monolithic whole in the West, as if it is composed of one single interpretation, or as if it were something static. That's not the case at all. There are different interpretations of Islam. There always have been. And I have experienced this, you know, firsthand in my childhood. There was a time when I grew up with two different grandmothers. The mother of my father was a woman whose interpretation of Islam was much more based on the element of fear. So her God was like an omnipresent celestial gaze, always watching you from above and writing down your sins. And I learned to be afraid of Allah from her. It was the Jalal side of God, a more masculine God. But when I came to this other grandmother, her world, her interpretation was quite different. It was a world full of superstitions. You know, you could always negotiate. It was more fluid. You could always flow. And it was based on love, not fear. At the first glance, these two women belong to the same age group. They're coming from the same society, from the same culture. Both are Muslim, but their interpretation was completely different. And I think the difference between a more orthodox interpretation of Islam and the more heterodox or Sufi-based interpretation of Islam is very much alive today, as it was in the past.
Well, you've described yourself as attached to Islamic as well as Jewish and Christian mysticism. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you're interested in mysticism, it means you're always traveling in the... you're trying to transcend the boundaries between religions, because the Sufi is someone who is after the essence of religion, not the outside appearance, but the inside, the very essence. And when you're after that essence, there's very little difference between religions. I'm very interested in Sufi thought, in Islamic mysticism, that tries to look at the inner meaning, not the outside appearances.
You wrote your new novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, in English. And you've described the Turkish language as having been purged when the modern Turkish state was created. Are there aspects of the Turkish language, the way it's spoken now, that you find to be inhibiting or not quite what you need to express what you want to say?
I wrote my first five novels in Turkish, but in a Turkish which is replete with old words, Ottoman words, expressions, and especially Sufi words. And that was a surprise for many people, because they were saying, you know, if you're not older than, you know, 60 years, or if you're not a conservative person, this is not the language you should be speaking. In Turkey, what we did was to Turkify the language, to get rid of words coming from Arabic origin or from Persian origin. And I think in time, our vocabulary shrunk. And when our vocabulary shrunk, our imagination shrunk rapidly. When we lost the words, we lost the meanings, the cultural heritage that they carried with them. So we didn't only lose the letters, we lost, you know, there's a huge cultural loss there. And I've always been very critical of this. I think when we're learning a new language, like when you're learning French or German or English, you spend more time, more energy, money for that. But you see your own language, your mother tongue, as a given, and you don't spend any energy for that. So my approach has been just the opposite, and that's maybe because I had to spend part of my childhood abroad, so I could never take my language for granted. And every time I came back to Turkey, I had spent more time for it. And I had to realize that language was not a static thing. You know, you might lose your language. That fear of losing my mother tongue made me more sensitive to this question in time. And I've started to study dictionaries, Ottoman dictionaries. So today my Turkish is very rich, precisely because I feared losing my Turkish as a child.
So when the Turkish state was created in 1923, certain Ottoman words were purged from the language, you say. And you've been trying to recapture some of those words. Can you give us an example of a word or a phrase that you think is really rich that you've used, even though it was basically written out of the language after 1923?
Well, one you know, very crucial example for me is colors and hues. In modern-day Turkish, I can, let's say, use 10 different words for colors. But we have lost the shades in between, because most of those shades, I mean the names for the shades and hues in between, let's say in between yellow and red, were coming from Persian origin. By taking out those words, you're losing the shades. What I'm trying to say is we lost the nuances of the language, and I've been very critical of that. But basically, people used to criticize me for you know, my passion for Ottoman words, and then they criticized me more when I started writing in English because they saw it as a cultural betrayal. The thing is, language is a very politicized theme in Turkey. Culture is a very politicized arena in Turkey. But basically, although these two things might look very, you know, disconnected, for me, they're very much related, because at the root of everything lies my passion and my love for language. Language for me is not a tool. It's not an instrument. I don't think I'm a writer who uses language. I breathe inside language. I write with and within language. So it is the labyrinth of language that makes it possible for me to imagine, to write. And that's crucial for me. I'm in love with the letters like a Jewish or Muslim mystic is in love with letters, with the meaning, with the miracle behind letters. That's a fascinating experience for me. And to this day, I think I do not have to make a choice between English and Turkish. There are certain things I'd rather write in Turkish, especially sorrow. I find it easier to express in Turkish. But maybe certain other things I'd rather write in English, because English is the language of precision. If you're looking for the precise word, it's out there. The vocabulary is immense. It's amazing. It's a more mathematical language for me. So depending on the theme, depending on the story, I might choose to write it either in Turkish or in English.
You've said that you can't write anything with an ironic tone in Turkish, that would be hard for you to do. You turn to English if you want to say something ironic.
Right, because It's a bit difficult to talk about this, but the tradition of irony, I mean, we have a very solid tradition of black humor, but black humor is not irony. Black humor as a very specific target, or we have a very solid tradition of political humor. But other than that irony, you know, making fun of yourself, not only of the world outside, this carnivalesque tradition in which the writer turns herself, the whole world upside down, that's more difficult to do in contemporary Turkish. I find that easier to do in English. But basically, for me, and I think people who are, you know, grown up bilingual or who have been traveling, commuting between different cultures might agree with me, every language brings you a new zone of freedom, a new zone of expression. It's a very existential journey. It's not only a linguistic journey. I have, for instance, met various middle-class or upper-class Turkish women who can never swear in Turkish because of the way they have been raised. You know, they always need to behave like good women in Turkish. But when they're speaking English, they can swear freely because it's okay to swear English. Every language gives you a new zone. And I find that experience, that discovery, fascinating.
You faced trial in Turkey because of things that you said in your new novel, The Bastard of Istanbul. And an Armenian journalist in Turkey was killed by somebody who objected to things that he wrote. And now there are many Turkish intellectuals and writers who are facing related threats. When you decided to become a writer, did you think that bravery was going to be one of the credentials that you'd need to be a novelist? Courage?
No, I didn't think. That never occurred to me. And, you know, when I look at myself, I am not a brave person at all. just the opposite. I'm a person who has lots of anxieties, lots of fears. But the thing is, I think I'm curious. I just like to ask questions. When somebody says, you know, don't transcend this frontier, this is a mental frontier, I'm curious about what's beyond that mental frontier. So curiosity is my guide, not courage.
Well, do you feel like you're becoming a courageous person, even though you don't think of yourself as being that way?
No, I really don't see myself as a courageous person. The only thing I can tell is when I'm writing fiction, my personality changes. You know, it is as if you're using a different part of your brain. Because when I'm writing, I'm following a story. I'm just following the footsteps of the characters as they shape themselves. So it's a completely different psyche. It's very different than who I am in my daily life. When the book is over, when the novel is over, I'm a more anxious, more timid person. I wish I could always be the person I am while I'm writing.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Elif Shafak's novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, has just been published in the U.S. She divides her time between Istanbul and Tucson, Arizona, where she's an assistant professor of Near Eastern Studies at the University of Arizona. Coming up, how we experience illness. This is Fresh Air. When Michael Stein was a young doctor and his brother-in-law Richard was dying of cancer, Stein wished he had a better vocabulary with which to discuss the emotional experience of pain and sickness. It was something he came to better articulate and understand as he became a more experienced doctor. Now he's written The Lonely Patient, How We Experience Illness, a look at illness from the perspectives of patients he's treated. Through their stories, the book examines four feelings stirred by the experience of illness: betrayal, terror, loss, and loneliness. It's Stein's first work of nonfiction. He's written four novels. He's a professor of medicine and community health at Brown University Medical School, and he heads HIV clinics in Rhode Island and the Dominican Republic. Let's start with a reading from The Lonely Patient.
Pain often comes as a surprise. Because it is usually limited, because it is almost always finite, patients are not overwhelmed at first, but instead are angry. With the slow discovery that it can become chronic, that one can slide without transition into what the novelist and memoirist Harold Brodkey called a gray, oily, uncertainly lit sleeve of almost complete pain, the sense that the body is betraying one increases. There is the experience of pain and the knowing that it will continue. Surprise turns to disbelief, then anger and rage, and finally depression and despair. There is something appalling about waking every morning knowing that pain will soon return, that it is close and coming fast, that one will be alone with it for another day, unable to stop it. There is a descent toward resignation and helplessness.
That's Dr. Michael Stein reading from his new book, The Lonely Patient. You know, I think for somebody who's really suffering, you know, there's your doctor who can, like, hopefully help you with some of the symptoms, but it can lead to such a kind of existential crisis, particularly if a patient is kind of almost at war with their body because they're so angry at their body for betraying them. And at some point, I think it's probably hard to tell whether you need, like, a philosopher, or, you know, a clergyman or a doctor.
Yeah, what I'm trying to do in this book is try to capture that what it's like to have an illness and live through it in real time. And it's difficult for every patient to put into words their thoughts. And I've tried to provide here some sort of emotional vocabulary for patients, but frankly, when you don't know what's coming next, you're not sure whether there's going to be good news, you're not sure whether there's going to be bad news, you just don't know, I think it leads to a very complicated state where sometimes you're fearful and sometimes you're passive, sometimes you're selfish and self-absorbed, sometimes you're bitter. It's very complicated, and patients often take it for granted when they walk into my office that all illness is knowable. All the explanations will be apparent. And of course, they should think that to some degree. They wouldn't come to see a doctor if they didn't believe that their doctor would make their best attempt to know about their illness. But the fact that is that illness is not all knowable, that what I tell patients is often agonizing for me and for them, it's agonizingly imprecise.
So much of your book is to try to capture in words the sensations of illness. And I'm sure some of your patients are really quite verbal and can describe really well what it is they're experiencing, what the problem is. And I would imagine that helps you understand the problem and better treat it. But I'm sure that a lot of your patients are not as verbal and have a more difficult time describing to you what it is that they're experiencing. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between treating verbal and nonverbal patients?
Well, I think it's more than being verbal and nonverbal. I think that there are some people who are not particularly curious about their illness. Even if they could speak about it, they don't want to speak about it. That speaking about illness is complaining, and people are brought up not to complain, and they know their doctors will reward them for not complaining. They don't want to speak of it because speaking of illness, complaining brings bad luck. Maybe they're superstitious and they may not speak about illness. But there are certainly people who don't experience illness or don't share their illness very much through words. And there are people who are ill who won't or can't tolerate introspection, who go through the process of illness in other ways. And there certainly are people like that. And that's just fine. People are different. And we have to approach them in other ways. We look for their gestures. We look for their face. They sometimes bring companions who they speak to in private. And we use the information that their companions bring. We have to be very careful listeners. But although I do think that the more people speak about these difficult feelings, their horror, their anguish, their losses, the better the chance of reducing some of their loneliness, some of the loneliness of illness. I don't think that, as you've said, speaking about illness is universal. There are certainly different styles of coping. But I do believe that whatever the style of coping, that illness brings on loneliness, and that loneliness is not a neutral emotion. Loneliness is a form of suffering.
You allude to something in your book, you know, that your father died in an emergency room when you were 13 years old. I guess I'm wondering what your memory of that is and how it's affected, if at all, how it affected your interest in becoming a doctor or the way you practice medicine?
Well, it's certainly been a theme in the novels that I've written. As you know, I've written four novels, and the idea of loss is one that comes up for me again and again. I think that the loss of my father at a young age, he was relatively young, and I was as you said, 13, it was certainly instructive to me. I had no, he'd been ill for a while at that point, so I had had some knowledge of the medical system, and the medical system back then was a little more primitive than it is now, but it certainly engaged me. And of course, wanting to be a doctor involves some belief that you can save people, and I think that theme in my life of wanting to save people probably derives from wanting to have saved my father at that young age.
My guest is Dr. Michael Stein. His new book is called The Lonely Patient. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with doctor and writer Michael Stein. His new book, The Lonely Patient, is his first work of nonfiction. As we've said, you know, your new book is about describing illness from a patient's point of view. Has your work as a doctor and your work as a writer affected how you deal with your own, you know, your own bouts of sickness or pain?
Well, I'm as terrified as the next person. I mean, I know what's coming, and in some ways, that's frightening in itself. A lot of terror is about anticipation, as well as the discomfort and pain of procedures and things as well. I've been fortunate to be relatively well at this point, but I am absolutely as vulnerable to all of the things that I describe in this book as the patients that I describe, and I think that in some ways that makes it easier for me. Now, does that come from writing? Now, writing is a procedure. When you write a novel or you write a book, that what you're trying to do is understand intimate relationships, and you're trying to understand what a person who's not you is feeling. And I think that experience of being a writer is in some ways similar to being a doctor, and they probably both inform the way I deal with my own illnesses, but I'm a baby too.
You know, you're very interested in people's descriptions of their illness and understanding illness from the patient's point of view. But are there times when you feel like a patient is like exaggerating their symptoms and, you know, overplaying it a little bit for whatever reason, and you have to recalibrate what you're hearing?
Well, you know, I think that that doctors and writers do sort of detective work, that what we do every day is listen for people's lies, and we listen for people's secrets. And that's what's in novels, and that's what I see in my office, that I sort of sometimes think of myself as a spy with a polite expression. I'm paid to be skeptical. Now, I'm also paid to be sentimental, and I'm paid to be tender, but I'm paid to be skeptical and to try to make sense of what a person's telling me. And if they're embellishing and they're trying to take me in a different direction than the facts seem to indicate, I'm need to be alert to that. I need to be both sympathetic but aware, because my job is to tell myself and then to tell them a story that makes sense. And that's what I need to do. And if they're telling me a story that doesn't make sense, I'm going to need to understand that better.
What impact do you think it has on your, you know, like, worldview to always be hearing stories of illness and suffering? I mean, do you get a sense that that, you know, pain and suffering are inevitable? I mean, certainly death is inevitable, but being surrounded by pain and suffering all the time and absorbing all of those stories and writing down those stories, does it make you feel, you know, any more kind of fragile and anxious yourself?
You know, doctors hear many good things, too. It's not all sadness. I wrote a line in the book, I think, that says something like, I come to work each day expecting sadness. And that's true to some degree, that, you know, people are only going to come in and see me when they're in trouble, when there's something that's happening to them that's incoherent or dreadful, and they're full of dread. And it is hard to be in the presence of that all the time, because it threatens to overwhelm the patient, it threatens to overwhelm me. But my day is also filled with people who are coming in who are grateful, people who are getting better, people who have recovered from something, people who want to tell me that they were able to play with their kids again. It's not all bad news, and that's the wonderful part of the job, is that we expect sadness, but sometimes we get many other things.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Michael Stein, his new book is called The Lonely Patient: How We Experience Illness. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble. With the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. From Rosalind Croman Swig, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Lives of Others, a spy film set in the former East Germany in 1984, has been nominated for an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film and is being released this week in the U.S. On the next Fresh Air, we meet the director. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.